Welcome to the February 2013 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. This issue is on the topic of low-grade gliomas. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Bob Carter of UC San Diego in San Diego, California, speaks with Dr. Daniel Cahill of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. They discuss Dr. Cahill and colleagues' editorial, Molecular Genetics of Low-Grade Gliomas, Genomic Alterations Guiding Diagnosis and Therapeutic Intervention. Their article appears in this month's issue.
Well, welcome to this podcast. I'm Dr. Bob Carter interviewing Dr. Daniel Cahill of the Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dan, it's a pleasure to have you here with us. Thank you for jumping in on this podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, Mitch Berger and I had the opportunity to edit this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus, which is on low-grade glioma. And I know that you've had a long-standing interest in neurosurgical oncology, and particularly your interest in recent years seem to have turned to the question of genetic alterations in low-grade glioma. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself, how you came to an interest in this area, and generally an introduction to what you're working on today?
Sure. So, as you know, I was in medical school at Johns Hopkins. While I was there, I got a PhD in the lab of Bert Fogelstein and Ken Kinzler, studying the genetics of human cancer. And that really was a key experience in my education and training, because I recognized that I wanted to work on this emerging aspect of the genomics of cancer. In the course of my training, both in medical school and then in residency, the human genome was completed, and then we started to really pursue detailed characterization of the genome of various cancers. You know, I realized that I wanted to make my life's work taking that knowledge and then trying to exploit that knowledge so that we would better treat patients by whatever means, through surgery or other treatments. And so that's what I do, and I try to understand how genomics helps us understand tumor categories better than our current knowledge. You know, there's always limitations of our current knowledge. And then try to understand how our therapies work or don't work or can be used better once this newer information emerges.
Thanks, Dan. You know, that's interesting. I remember a few years ago, one of your early questions as you got into the neurosurgical and neurosurgical oncology area was, what happens to tumors when they've received treatment in certain subsets of gliomas? And if I understand correctly your work, you showed that there's the emergence in some patients of what's known as a hypermutator phenotype. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this was a fortuitous finding early, and you know, as we were characterizing the genomes of cancers. And sequencing wasn't as inexpensive as it is currently. And so what we had to do was identify certain areas of the genome that we thought would be druggable. So at the time, it was kinase screening. We would look for mutations across kinases. And this kind of strategy had proved to be spectacularly successful in a couple of other tumor types. The most famous, which I think people would know of nowadays, is BRAF mutations in melanoma. So in 2002 and 2003, those were discovered as part of a kinase screen that the Sanger group in Cambridge had performed. So we did something similar for glioblastomas. And what we had found was that there were a subset of tumors that had orders of magnitude higher mutations than their counterparts. And we tried to understand, you know, it hadn't been previously described that gliomas would be a hypermutator tumor. Hypermutator tumors were usually restricted to colon cancers or some ovarian endometrial cancers. It was not well known that they would be brain tumors. And it turned out these were not hypermutator tumors to start with. They only became hypermutators after they had been treated with temozolomide chemotherapy. And the reason why that was is because it was a resistance mechanism. So it was a way for the tumor to evolve around the treatment of temozolomide and to avoid it. And what was striking about that finding was it was the first, really in any tumor type, genetic evidence that there was selection in response to treatment occurring. So what was happening was temozolomide was really working. It was killing the majority of the tumor cells, but there were certain subpopulations of tumor cells that were developing resistance by having mismatch repair gene defects, which would allow the cells to grow despite the toxic effects of temozolomide. So it was
That's
evidence.
Very interesting. So, you know, I recall that paper was published in a very high-profile journal and got a lot of attention at the time. And has that informed some of your current efforts in terms of low-grade glioma and the genetic mutations that you're examining there?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that what happens there is that, you know, we know temozolomide works for glioblastoma. It causes a statistically significant deflection of the survival curve. And we know that chemotherapy works for a certain class of low-grade gliomas, and that's the oligodendrogliomas. And so, you know, a big part of my initial effort was to try to understand that class at the genomic level because it's very chemosensitive. On the other hand, the astrocytomas, the low-grade astrocytomas, they really have no clear, well-established therapy that prolongs survival. The low-grade glioma trials looking at radiation therapy showed that either upfront or delayed therapy resulted in the same survival, and certainly the chemotherapeutic response data has been mixed as well. So that's a real puzzle, is what should we offer astrocytic tumors that are low-grade? And then, you know, what is the role of surgery in the treatment of all of these cancers? You know, it's hard to speak about a category of tumor without implicitly thinking about surgery, because the way we diagnose and categorize tumors is by doing surgery on them and getting a piece of the tumor and then characterizing it. But then also surgery is therapeutic because we try to take out as much tumor as possible. And, you know, there are certain tumors that seem to do very well when we do surgery on them. And then there are other patients where we do a very good job at surgery and then they seem to have progressive disease very quickly. And part of what we do is try to understand how our different treatments, you know, vary in these different subgroups.
Now, one of your focuses in this paper, in this issue of Neurosurgical Focus, is to really emphasize IDH1 in a very comprehensive way. I very much enjoyed reading your paper. Can you tell us a little bit about IDH1, how it came to your particular interest and its emergence into the scientific literature? Because it appears to me, and I think most readers who've followed this story, that this has just really been an explosion of new data in the last 5 years. For our Neurosurgical Focus listeners, could you bring us up to speed somewhat on IDH1 and its relationship in these early tumors of glioma origin?
Yes, no, absolutely. And it is true. The IDH1 data and discovery in glioma has really exploded on the field. As we learn more and more about it, it has basically completely rewritten the paradigm for our understanding of how we should categorize these tumors. So the key finding was initially made in 2008, and that was when Will Parsons, who is a postdoc in my former graduate school lab, did a whole genome sequencing screen on glioblastomas. They had looked at about 20 patients, and they had biased the discovery set of patients for younger patients. And it turned out that 5 of 22 cases had mutations in the IDH1 gene at a very specific spot, R132H, which is a specific codon in the gene. And the mutation was heterozygous. It had the appearance of an oncogenic mutation, so something like the BRAF mutation. And to this day, it's still a little unusual. We don't understand exactly why this mutation promotes the formation of cancer. But we have, you know, there have been developing theories about it. Regardless, as a classification tool, as an ability to classify tumors, it has proved to be remarkable. So Andreas von Daimling's group in Germany developed a mutation-specific antibody that's really in wide use and has rapidly spread to neuropathology groups, and they can use it to stain specifically for this mutation in tumors. And what we find is that the vast majority, 70, 80, 90% of low-grade gliomas, grade 2s and grade 3s, have this mutation or a similar mutation in a cognate gene, IDH2. And it's such a huge percentage of the tumors have this mutation that it makes you start to wonder that the few that do not have the mutation are maybe just miscategorized tumors, because we all know that there's some inter-observer variability in the diagnosis by histopathology. And you could start to think about making a new classification paradigm such that instead of saying, okay, this is a grade 2 tumor, a grade 3 tumor, a grade 4 tumor, where you could just rework your entire construct of understanding tumors and say these are IDH mutant tumors, let's consider them as a group, and then IDH wild type tumors, we consider those as a group, and see if our understanding of patients' response to treatment, patients' outcome, is better explained using this new paradigm instead of using the old grading paradigm.
So here your analogy would be that much like the 1P19Q loss in oligodendroglioma, this would be a very distinct genetic signature that would essentially create a new classification with implications for prognosis and potentially therapy for that subclassification of patients who are, again, IDH1 mutant positive. Is that correct?
Exactly. And I think that's a great analogy, because what happened when 1P19Q was found to be linked to chemotherapeutic response, people recognized that 1P19Q loss was more frequently found in oligodendrogliomas. But there was a struggle within the neuropathology community where the diagnosis of oligodendroglioma or tumors with oligodendroglial component started to increase. But it turned out that ultimately at the core, and this was just proven in the last year, the tumors that actually respond to treatment with chemotherapy and have prolonged survival with chemotherapy are just the tumors that are 1P19Q deleted. So it was the molecular definition which was the key for identifying patients for treatment. Pathologists could call something an oligodendroglioma. If it didn't have 1P19Q loss, it still didn't respond to treatment. And so, as it turns out, virtually every tumor that has 1P19Q loss also has an IDH1 mutation. So IDH1 mutation is found both in oligodendrogliomas and astrocytomas. So it starts to define this category as a larger group, and then there seems to be subgroups within the IDH mutant category of tumors that have 1P19Q loss, and then the other tumors which, you know, we consider to be astrocytomas or astrocytic tumors.
Very interesting. And I think the IDH1 story is fascinating, and I know that you're perhaps not directly working on this, although perhaps you are. You can update me. Tell us a little bit about IDH1 and therapeutic implications directly targeting that pathway. I understand that there's a whole new area of metabolomics that mm-hmm. is really burgeoning as a result of this IDH1 story.
Right, and so that is true. Because it is a oncogenic mutation, in the past, when drugs have been designed to specifically target oncogenic mutations, such as this one, they have proved to be spectacularly successful for those patients. So the examples are obvious. BRAF mutation in melanoma with the BRAF-targeted drugs, EGFR mutations in lung cancer with the EGFR-targeted drugs. And so, and because this is a mutation in a metabolic enzyme, the ability to target it, you know, is something that pharmaceutical companies, you know, they can design enzymatic assays and inhibition of this enzyme, and they've done that in order to try to see if it can then be targeted as a mechanism to treat these cancers. It turns out that this exact mutation is also found in some other tumor types. So it's found in acute leukemias, it's found in cholangiocarcinomas, it's found in chondrosarcomas, and maybe potentially even other tumors. So it turns out that just targeting this one mutation type may prove to be a successful treatment for a wide variety of cancers. There have been many companies that have started drug development efforts looking at this, probably the most high profile of which is this company called Agios. And they have longstanding interest in targeting metabolic abnormalities of tumors. And they made some of the seminal discoveries looking at the metabolic effects of having this mutation, identifying the oncometabolite 2-hydroxyglutarate as a novel product of this enzyme. And they've done some early work looking at inhibitors of this enzyme. This is a rapidly moving field, and there's a lot of competitors in this area.
Sounds like there'll be more on that story. So what I'm hearing from you then is, at this point, from a prognostic perspective, classification of really any low-grade glioma patient, be it of the oligodendroglial variety or simply astrocytic variety, to know IDH1 status gives us prognostic information today. Mm-hmm. And do you sense that that's emerging as part of a standard toolkit analysis for all tumors, basically, of these low-grade varieties at this point?
So yes, I agree. I think it is emerging as a standard for the diagnosis of these tumors. And I would argue really that every glioma should be stained for this antibody. And I think, in many centers, that is what has become the practice. The reason for that is beyond prognosis. It allows you to have certainty about a diagnosis. There are a lot of clinical scenarios that happen commonly in the neurosurgical practice that are informed by knowing the IDH status of a tumor. A classic would be if we biopsy something and we're only able to get a few fragments of a tumor, but the tumor looks very aggressive when we look at it, you know, on the MRI scan, and that we're worried that this patient has glioblastoma, but the pathologist is only able to see enough criteria on the fragments that we've provided to them to call it anaplastic. But when they stain it and it's IDH wild type, you know for almost certain that that's going to act similarly to a glioblastoma, you know, as a clinical course. And when you look at, you know, the classic neuropathology studies, there's a tight volume pathology relationship. So how much tumor is taken out and provided to the pathologist for a biopsy versus a full resection, you know, really shades whether or not the patient gets a grade 3 or a grade 4 diagnosis ultimately. But when we look at IDH staining, it has no volume relationship. It's independent of how much tumor is taken out. And that's the kind of thing that can help us. It can help you be more certain that we should, you know, this is a patient who should get treated as if they have a glioblastoma versus this is a patient who maybe has a lower grade etiology lesion, something that we have more time to work up. Maybe somebody who needs a second staged operation, you know, they could have a better operation and they have time to get that operation. So it helps a lot.
That's very helpful. And it sounds also that that you're of the mind that these types of additional molecular diagnostics really help the neuropathologist give a more full and detailed picture of the clinical scenario. So, Dan, to the extent that we're able to increasingly sequence tumors and really have a wealth and abundance of specific genetic data, do you see the emergence of additional markers, or have we already hit the big ones with IDH1 and the 1P19Q loss, or do you think that there's a treasure trove of additional markers that will enable us to parse out subsets of patients even within these general classifications as to their treatment response and prognosis?
The answer is I do. I think the most straightforward example is IDH1 was the category of low-grade tumors, and 1P19Q loss was the oligodendrogliomas. And then there was work by my group in collaboration with lots of other groups, you know, who simultaneously discovered the CIC gene, and that's the, you know, that is the 1P19Q gene. And then on the counterpart, the astrocytic tumors are characterized by ATRX mutations, and that work was just recently done in the last year. And no matter what, we still don't have a good explanation for the grading concept. So the idea that IDH tumors can be either low-grade or high-grade. You know, there are IDH mutant glioblastomas. In the RTOG data set, it was about 7% of what are histologically glioblastomas and are aggressive cancers. The patients die within about 3 years or so. And we don't know what the additional mutations are that explain that sort of transformation process. Obviously, it's not IDH because that's found in also very low-grade lesions where patients live for decades. You know, there's a lot of expectation that there is going to be further molecular causes to identify these groups. On the other hand, IDH wild-type tumors are currently characterized by the absence of IDH mutations. So that means that that's likely to be a very heterogeneous population still. There's probably still other groups that can be found within IDH wild-type tumors that will break down and explain the different responses to treatment there.
Very, very interesting. Dan, you know, I think the lessons I've taken away from your story is that your dedication and your focus in this area, your PhD in the Vogelstein lab and continuing on with your postdoctoral work with David Lewis and then now emerging as a leading faculty member at Mass General who's studying these genetic alterations is the consistent and applied effort in a given research area can really bear fruit. So I really congratulate you for your contributions to the field, and we're delighted to have your article in this issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for being on with me today.
Thank you very much for the kind words. Obviously, my contributions have been very small compared to the contributions of others, but it is a very exciting field to work in, there's no question. So thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the February issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the March issue when the topic will be cranial nerve surgery. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter and now also on Facebook.